This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Fans of the HBO series The Wire, or viewers who missed it on television, can now complete their set. The fifth and final season of the series, which centered on Baltimore cops and drug dealers, as well as the city's politicians, educators, and journalists, is now out on DVD. Here's a scene from season four in which Omar, a character who robs drug dealers for a living, bursts in on a card game and confronts Marlo Stanfield, the biggest drug dealer in West Baltimore.
All right, everybody, let me see them hands, yo. Hands! Hey, yo, big man, back up.
I don't know about cars, but I think these four fives be the full house.
Hey, yo, banker, cash me out, yo. Boy, you want a hit on that body, you best hop too.
That's my money.
Man, money ain't got no owners. Only spenders. I tell you something else. I like that ring, too.
This ain't over.
Well, that's how you carrying the shorty.
Huh? Because I can find your peoples a whole lot easier than they can find me.
Wear it in health.
No doubt.
Omar is played by Michael K. Williams, Marlo Stanfield by Jamie Hector. The mortal hostility between Omar and Marlo is one of the storylines of Season 5, along with the failure of the city's newspaper to grapple with the complex problems that confront the city. The series creator and writer of many episodes is David Simon, a former reporter at the Baltimore Sun. Many of the stories and characters in The Wire are based on his reporting. Simon's also the author of the nonfiction book Homicide, A Year on the Killing Streets, which was adapted into the NBC series Homicide. Terry spoke to David Simon in March.
You had to decide what the fate of each of the characters would be as the series ended. Who gets to live, who gets to die, who gets a second chance, who lives a life of misery.
Yom Kippur in the writer's room.
Can you talk a little bit about what the process was like of deciding the fate of some of our favorite characters?
Well, we've been stealing big. I mean, we've been stealing from a lot of the Greek tragedies. And a lot of the characteristics of the protagonists in those plays are apparent in The Wire. And usually if someone's demonstrating that, they're going to get it.
Can you give me an example?
Hubris, a willingness to challenge the gods, a willingness to engage in an argument against one's fate. The same things that, you know, Antigone or Oedipus struggled with, we gave the same sort of dynamic to our characters. So there wasn't a lot of escaping that. We knew where people were going for a long time based on that logic.
Who are the gods?
The gods are the post-industrial institutions of modern life.
City hall, the police department, the school system.
Whoever you serve, wherever your paycheck comes from, whatever calling you thought you had, on The Wire, there's every possibility it will betray you.
You know, the Wire doesn't present any easy answers. There's no real, like, solutions. But we do get a sense of how and why the system doesn't work. We don't learn how to fix it necessarily, but we do come away, I think, with a kind of understanding of the victims within that system. And you walk away with a sense of empathy for people who you might never come in contact with in the real world and might be able to, you might be able to, like, demonize them. But watching this series, you just develop empathy for so many people in so many different
situations. I hope so.
Situations.
I do.
Was that one of the things you wanted to do?
Yeah. I mean, I think, in fact, that's about the only victory that you could ask for from a television drama. I think you can't become too didactic and start spouting policy. Having said that, I mean, I think it's the lack of empathy that has led to this disastrous and venal drug war. If we've said anything with The Wire, we've tried to critique the drug war for being what it is. It is no longer, in places like West Baltimore, it is no longer a war against dangerous narcotics. It may have begun as such, but now it is a war against the underclass. And it's being fought by people who have against people who have not. And it is as cynical an exercise as anything I've ever seen. And I was a newspaper reporter for a lot of years. And so if there was a credible critique of anything politically, we hope that was it with the show.
As you said, you were a reporter for the Baltimore Sun for many years and covered crime for many years. And I have February 1994 article from the Baltimore Sun that you wrote that was headlined, "Drugs, a War with Feudal Tactics." And I just want to read an excerpt of that because I think what you were reporting in 1994 is evident in The Wire. You wrote, "There is simply no prison or jail space available for Baltimore street-level drug offenders, and given the realities of Maryland's fiscal condition, little likelihood that more prison space will soon become available. Nevertheless, much of the Baltimore Police Department's effort in the war on drugs remains geared to arresting street-level violators. The rate of drug arrests in Baltimore remained nearly three times the national average for cities of comparable size in 91, the last year in which such statistics were available. Why? Many reasons, say veteran commanders and officers, not the least of which is the simple overriding fact that no arrest is easier than a street-level lockup for drugs." And then you end the article later by quoting a cop by saying, "The people in these neighborhoods know who the more serious traffickers are, and they know who the people doing the shootings are. When they see the police coming through and leave those people be while grabbing up some small-time tout or junkie, they lose any faith they ever had." So I just read that as an example of how your police reporting informed
what's
in The Wire. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's myself. It's Bill Zorzi, who covered politics for The Sun. It's Ed Burns, who policed Baltimore and then taught in the schools for 7 years. The show is rooted in people who are rooted in a real place. And that's improbable for television. And that's what I think that's what everyone felt was so subversive. It was a very idiosyncratic message from a very real place.
Let me ask you about another story that you wrote that one of the characters in The Wire is kind of based on. And the story was headlined, "The Metal Men, with quick drug money as their goal, they're stealing and selling every bit of aluminum, iron, brass, and copper they can cart out of city buildings." This is Dateline September 3rd, 1995. And the story was about mostly junkies who were scavenging the city, taking like metal and aluminum off of buildings to sell to companies for scrap. And they were not only doing this out of on abandoned buildings, but they were sometimes taking apart usable, currently in use buildings and destroying them. And here's like one quote from a character named Gary, one of the metal men. And you write, "Gary is the rare metal man. He won't lie about any of it. Fact is, when he's sated with chemicals and the nausea is gone and he can think about things for a few minutes, he's genuinely ashamed. Quote, 'We tore up the boiler in this school for $70 in copper,' he says. 'For $70, we did like $10,000 in damage." Can you talk a little bit about how you got onto the story and what?
Sure.
Any of the repercussions of it, you know, the after effects of it were?
Well, actually, that was the story that ended my career in journalism. You happened to have come across it. Those are the repercussions for me, anyway. There were no repercussions in the outside world, I don't think. I think business went on as usual. But the Gary that you quote is Gary McCullough. And I, you know, 3 years later, I published a book about him called The Corner. And he's no longer with us, but the main characters he was one of the guys, but I actually followed other people to keep it separate from the book for the main narrative of that story. That story got spiked by the editor of the Baltimore Sun without explanation, and I think it was towards the end when I had started to critique the paper from within and started to, you know, make arguments for the journalism that I valued. I think he was quite disappointed with me. So he actually, the story was as it ran, ultimately he spiked it. And when I went in to talk with him, it became a wide-ranging conversation about me getting on the team and not criticizing and a variety of things that were as institutional as anything you'd ever see in The Wire. And then one of his other editors came in and said to him, "I don't know why you spiked that story that, you know, you brought me to here to do that kind of work, and, you know, why is that sitting in the kill basket? So it ran in the magazine. He wouldn't run it in the paper. He put it in the Sunday magazine, which was on its last legs then. They were about to kill it. But I had made up my mind as a result of sort of that conversation that it was time for me to leave journalism. Because to me, that story was what I valued. It was a nuanced narrative. It held what was happening to account. It talked about the damage done, but it did so in human terms.
So this is an example of why you're so cynical about some editors in The Wire, because there's a couple of editors in The Wire
I'm cynical about everybody in management.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't think they differ from, you know, Valchek. One of the police commanders, he destroys a man because they're fighting over the place of a stained glass window in a Catholic church. So I don't think we're any more cynical about the editors than we are about politicians or police commanders. I think some newspapermen got a little bit upset about it, but journalism's a little bit self-absorbed and onanistic, and it was all fun and games when we were making fun of politicians and police commanders and school superintendents, but God forbid you mock the foibles of an editor-in-chief somewhere, and now you got trouble.
Let's get back to Terry's conversation with David Simon, creator of the HBO series The Wire. Before the break, they talked about Gary McCullough, a junkie and metal scavenger who inspired the character of Bubbles on The Wire. David Simon and his co-executive producer Ed Burns, a former Baltimore police detective, shadowed Gary for a year while they were working on their book The Corner. Simon says Gary had no problem with them following him while he engaged in illegal conduct.
Gary was sort of an open soul. He was Gary was interested in everything. You know, Gary would get high and go to his basement and read. I'll never forget, Gary read Karen Armstrong's History of God.
Really?
The year that we were following him. You know, when Gary one time,
that's
he wanted
pretty,
to...
That's a lot of scholarship. That's not...
It was. And, yeah. And Gary was, he was just open to the world. And the idea that, I should tell a story here, which is that Ed and I would go up to the Corners late in 92, and say, we're going to do a book here, we're this. I'm the guy who wrote Homicide. Ed was a police detective, yes. I know you remember him. I know he once served a warrant on you. Stop, eyeing him. He is now retired. We're going to do a book. Please trust us. And everyone would go, cops. nobody believed us. And then we went into Gary's mother's house up on Vine Street and met Gary in the living room. And we gave him the same spiel, and he looked at us and went, okay, great. This is going to be an amazing book. He was a little bit credulous, which was part of his problem in the drug culture. He suffered from being a little bit credulous. In our case, we weren't lying, but he was really open to the world. And we followed Gary everywhere. And part of that is he's a little bit preoccupied trying to get through the day, but part of it was just his nature.
So when you were watching Gary steal metal and you knew it was going to be bad for the city and bad for some individuals whose homes or offices he was scavenging from, did it present any moral dilemmas to you as the witness to it?
I confess it didn't. Let me take it a step further. When Ed Burns and I were in that neighborhood in 1993, there was a guy killed. Murdered, stabbed to death on the street, and we knew who did it. We weren't eyewitnesses, but we had all the information as to who did it, why they did it, how it happened, who said what to whom just before the knife went in. I mean, we had the whole thing. Ed had been a former homicide detective, and I had many friends in the homicide unit from having done the previous book on the homicide unit, and we did not pick up the phone and call. When we came into that neighborhood, we told everybody that we were there as journalists, not as police, not as any other arm of the government, that we were there to record life in that neighborhood of Franklin Square and around those drug corners for 1 year. When I gave my word to anybody, in any regard, it's my word. And I have to abide by the terms of the situation if I've given my word. And so, there was no real practical way that I could start mitigating that because certain things had happened. You can't play that way. I was there under certain terms, mm-hmm. and I wanted to be able to look everybody in the eye and say, when I told you all this stuff back in 92 about how we would behave, we kept our word.
There's a lot of fantastic African-American actors on The Wire, most of whom I'd never seen before in other roles. How did you get the word out when you were casting?
That's Alexa Fogle, and it's Pat Moran in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
There is a wonderfully deep reservoir of African-American talent. There really is, and they're not working. There's just not enough work. Nobody's writing the parts. What they are writing is marginal at best. And so there's just a natural hunger there. And, I mean, our second and third choices for some of these roles were great reads. You know, sometimes we came back and used them for something else later in the run. I always bristle when I hear people on shows that are supposedly race neutral in their casting. And you know, they come out lily white and somebody asks them about it and they say, well, you know, there's just not that level of talent, you know, among black actors. I hear that. I get furious.
Do you have a favorite casting story?
That's an interesting. Oh, I'll give you a casting story. So we're going to read Wendell Pierce for Bunk.
This is one of the detectives.
Yes, absolutely, and a true character. And by the way, the real Bunk is in our heads because he was named Oscar Requier, and he was quite a character. And he's a wonderful guy, retired now from the police department, just retired. And so Ed and I have this guy in our heads, and you know, Wendell comes in to read in New York, and he just nails it. He is Bunk. You know, and like we're so solid that this is, you know, if this guy's available, the show begins with us casting him. And then after he apologizes, he was a little late for the and a little flustered. He didn't think he did well, and he started telling this long story about getting in an argument with a New York cab driver about who wouldn't pick him up because he was black, and you know, he was trying to get here and this and that, and this was the night before, and he got locked up. Like, you know, he got in an argument and the police locked him up. And it was in the telling of that story I was holding my side. He told it, you know, in classic Bunk fashion. It came out as if Oscar Requier had been telling it in the Baltimore Homicide Unit. And so the telling of the story was like, you know, no, we don't need to call you back. We're going to call you back when we have a McNulty and you'll read with him, but you're Bunk. And I'll never forget the story because he was infuriated and apologetic at the same time and funny. And that's, you know, to do all three things in a long anecdote in front of a couple of producers and a director and a casting agent. I thought it was a tour de force.
Did you shoot in places that you'd never go to on your own without cameras and a crew because they were too dangerous?
I was a police reporter for a lot of years, and I felt that my city was not Beirut. It was not Fallujah. It was a place that I ought to be able to go with a notepad and talk to somebody if they needed to be interviewed. And so there was no place that I felt like I wouldn't go. I admit to being squeamish when I would have to get in the lifts and, you know, in the elevators
at
the Murphy Homes or the Lexington Terrace, at the high rises, mm-hmm. which are no longer there. You know, just that sense of going up and, you know, you got to talk to somebody in Unit 10B, you know, in the 770 building and, you know, you're going up and or the lift is broken. You got to climb the stairs and you're walking past drug deals. That was kind of creepy because, like, you know, I'm going up and I got to come back down. But I always felt like you get about 5 minutes on the street if you know where you're going when everyone's trying to figure out whether you're worth robbing or not. You know, you get that 5 minute, like, is that a social worker or is it a cop or I can't, you know, what's that notepad about? And in that delay, I felt like I could go anywhere. And I have to say, you know, I never got robbed in years of being a police reporter and going into every neighborhood in the city. The one time I got robbed, I was with Gary McCullough doing the corner book, and Ed and I were dressed.
Is the metal man, Gary?
Yeah, mm-hmm. He was going to cop. Or actually, we were not going to cop. We were just walking on Fulton Avenue, and Ed Burns and myself and Gary and. They thought we looked like two white guys, you know, with Gary who were looking a cop. So they held us up for, you know, the $2.50 I had in my pocket, and it was all very officious and, you know, inform, you know, sort of like pro forma. And then they said, "Is this all you got?" And we were like, "Yeah." And they were like, "Okay, done. That's it. That's the sole extent of the of my violent encounters in Baltimore, Maryland.
Well, David Simon, our time is up. I just want to thank you so much for The Wire.
I want to thank you
for this conversation. Thank you so much.
I want to thank you. I've been a fan for a long time. I really have been.
David Simon speaking with Terry Gross in March. Simon created the HBO series The Wire. He's currently working on a pilot for HBO set in post-Katrina New Orleans. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Literary editor Ted Solotaroff died Friday from complications of pneumonia. He was 79. Solotaroff had been a force in shaping the American literary scene since 1967, when he founded the literary journal New American Review, which he also edited. In the review and in his work at publishing houses, he maintained a commitment to emerging writers and a determination not to get caught up in literary fads. Over the years, he published several acclaimed first books, including Bobby Ann Mason's collection of short stories, Joan Chase's novel During the Reign of the Queen of Persia, Sue Miller's The Good Mother, and Lynn Sharon Schwartz's Rough Strife. He also edited books by Russell Banks, Robert Bly, and Max Appel. Solotaroff worked as an editor at the New American Library, Simon & Schuster, Bantam Books, and Harper & Row. Terry Gross spoke to Ted Solotaroff in 1987 upon the publication of his book, A Few Good Voices in My Head.
You've worked with many young writers. I'd like to talk with you about some of your experiences when you were a young writer. And you came to New York when you were young. And you say you wrote that you came to New York sustained by the endless modern legend of the artist as outsider. What did living the artist's life mean to you? What were your expectations?
Well, very different from those I think young writers start out today, partly because our models were, you know, Joyce or Flaubert, who didn't really get anywhere for 10, 15 years of their careers, or William Faulkner, you know, publishing novel after novel down there in Jefferson, Mississippi, and no one really paying any attention to him to speak of until he won the Nobel Prize 25 years into his career. The whole notion of the modern artist was that of a sort of marginal, alienated writer who was much more responsible to the happy few, the small community of letters, as it were, than he was to anything like a large audience. And this was not only true in writing, it was also true in painting, it was also true, say, in jazz. I mean, you know, what did someone like Charlie Parker earn in a week? or you know, the painters who later became millionaires were in the 1940s, early 1950s, kind of living the lifestyle of truck drivers in the village.
Well, you were a waiter for many years.
I was a waiter myself, yeah. And one took that for granted. One expected that you would, you know, learn your craft over a period of maybe 10 years. And if you didn't want to pay those dues, well, then, you know, find something else that was easier and more secure and better paying to do. I think so many young writers today come into it with the notion that they too can be, you know, Bret Ellis or Jay McInerney overnight. Talk today about a struggling young writer, and it's you're probably talking to someone who already thinks of himself as a failure, which is crazy.
When you were getting started as a writer, you had difficulty writing about your own experiences. You were from a Jewish middle-class family. You didn't really want to write about that. You didn't want to write about what your life had been like in college or your experiences with the jobs that you've had. Why was it so difficult for you to write about firsthand experiences? What did you think you should be writing about?
Well, it was more a matter of the kind of form that it took. That you know, I wrote about my own experience in ways that tended to make it as much like James Joyce's as I could. other writers tried to write about theirs and make it as much like Hemingway's as they could. You know, in other words, that the power of the forms and of the mentors of those forms, like Hemingway, like Joyce, or if you were a poet, like Eliot or Pound or Stevens, William Carlos Williams, tended to if not engender your experience, certainly push you in one direction or another in choosing what it was to write about. And so you tried to write about things that that had large elements in it of ritual, of symbol, of, in other words, that fitted into the modern canon of literature. And, you know, if you're 50 years old and have had a lot of experience and can sort of understand then what experiences were particularly symbolic of the rest of your life, that's a fairly, you know, legitimate way to perceive. But for a 24-year-old to try to take that little pool of experience he somehow managed to pull together and try to find in it, you know, universal meanings and so on is so much to put the cart before the horse that the horse never gets out of the barn.
We were just talking about how when you started writing, you wrote as if it were James Joyce experiencing your life. There's a wonderful revelation that you describe in one of your essays. You say you realized that you didn't want to write about your life because what you wanted from writing was a self different from your own life.
Yeah.
I think that really describes a lot of artists who don't want to write about their own experiences because they hope by virtue of being an artist they'll become somebody more interesting or more different than what they think of themselves as having been. What gave you that revelation?
Well, I think it was mainly just that I had come to the end of that line of trying to have a literary self that was so much, you know, fancier and more sophisticated and more refined than the actual person who was working as a waiter and was, you know, trying to somehow make ends meet. And the whole notion of the artist as some superior being, I think, was quite a dangerous one. As dangerous in its way as the artist, as an entrepreneur, as a guy with a product to sell, is as dangerous today. I think that one of the ways I sort of began to get out of this was first as a teacher and then as an editor. And I think one of the things that my essays show and that my whole career shows in a way is how editing and writing have been a kind of bonded activities for me. The one tends to not only reinforce the other, but to guide it. It was editing that made me begin teaching first, teaching composition, which is a form of editing in a way, which began to make me see that people had to write about what mattered to them for the writing to be any good.
And you could see that as an outsider working with somebody else's writing.
That's right. And the things that really mattered to me didn't seem to be worthy of literature when I was starting out. It was only later on that I realized that made that mistake, which was the revelation you spoke about.
Another revelation you describe in your book that I also very much liked is that you realized by going it alone, by living the solitary artist's life, that you weren't necessarily going to get strength and courage. You might end up being bitter and spiteful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a line in there of Yeats, "Too long a sacrifice can make a stone of the heart." And that's what I was beginning to feel. And it's sort of what made me stop that way of life, go to graduate school, and eventually end up as an editor who found writing criticism made more sense than writing fiction, though I must say that now in my sort of middle age, I've come back to writing fiction again with a much different attitude than I had when I started out.
How is that attitude different?
Oh, well, it's much less burdened by all sorts of voices, bad voices in my head, saying, look who thinks he's a fiction writer. I mean, if James Joyce was a fiction writer, how can you think of yourself as a fiction writer? I don't bother with that kind of self-intimidation anymore.
Well, here's another kind of intimidation you could experience, the editing intimidation. I think a lot of editors are afraid to write fiction because they think that their writers will think, oh, well, he thinks he's such a hot editor. Look at what he's writing. It's no better than what I'm writing.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. I sort of figure that any of my authors who say, hey, you know, come on, man, look what you're writing. when you've just been telling me not to, you know, not to write in this way or that way, and now you're doing that. And, you know, I guess I would say, well, look, you know, friend, I if I can't beat you, I have to join you.
When you started editing, was it important that you not see yourself as a failed writer?
Well, actually, I did. It was helpful to see myself as one in a way because it I don't think myself so much as failed as kind of misdirected, and it helped me to have a certain amount of sympathy and a certain amount of insight into particular problems that writers might have. I mean, every story, every essay, every novel is, to some extent or other, not always, but usually, a failure of one kind or another. It might just be a minor failure, which the editor then comes along and tries to help the author to correct, improve, strengthen, what have you. And that whole, you know, feeling that somehow, even though things haven't worked out or aren't working out entirely well, that still the work can be redeemed, is very much part of the editor's philosophy. It tends to put writing into, I think, the right perspective, which is essentially rewriting. That one starts out with, you know, kind of setting down a mess, and it's only later on up the road that you are able to see the strength, to see the coherence, to see the import implications of what you've been doing. And I think that so many failed writers fail because they expect that first version to somehow prove their credentials. I was very heartened once to read Thurber talking about how his wife would sometimes go over and look at a first draft he'd written and say, "Thurber, you know, that looks like it was written, you know, by you when you were 12. and he would say, "Precisely, it was. It's the 12-year-old in me who gets those first drafts down. It's only the mature writer who finishes them." And that sense of process, which an editor becomes very, very steeped in, because, you know, you're constantly dealing with the process of a book.
Well, you know, I remember when I interviewed Scott Spencer, he was telling me that he always has to fool himself when he's writing, to fool himself into thinking that everything he's writing is perfect, that it could go right into the printing press. Mm-hmm. Then after he writes it, he realizes what he knew in the back of his mind all along, is that this is several rewrites away from being any good at all. Now, you work with writers who have written thinking, okay, this is ready for the printing presses. They've maybe done several drafts before they've even brought the book to you. And then you sometimes have the job of saying to them, "Whoa, you've really got to start all over again."
Well, not usually. If it's something that I'm very interested in, the chances are that 70-80% of the book is already there. Otherwise, I'm asking them to write a different book than the one they've written.
Mm-hmm.
There's a beautiful analogy Michelangelo used when someone said, you know, "How do you get such wonderful living textures out of marble?" And he said, "Oh, the figure's already in the marble. I just chip away what's covering it." And similarly, in a way, an editor is kind of helping the writer chip away what's covering the final, form, the final power of his work. That's why so much of editing is cutting. Taking out those sentences or paragraphs that aren't necessary, that kind of slow the movement, that obscure the point, and so on.
You know, I'm glad you brought up the question of cutting. You said so much of editing is cutting. I read a lot of books for my work here, hosting this interview program, and I am faced with so many 700-page books that seem like they should have been 200 pages, and mm-hmm. some 500-page books that seem like they maybe should have been really good essays, like mm-hmm. one essay. Uh-huh. Could have really summed it up. Is there less cutting away in the publishing world than there used to be? I sometimes think maybe a lot of editors are taking long lunch breaks and not paring away the way they're supposed to be.
Well, that's a large question in a way, because what's happened, I think, is publishing stopped being a profession and it's become a business. That's a very important distinction, at least in my mind. A profession has certain standards of performance, certain values that really must be respected if you are to call yourself a professional. And editing as a profession is one in which you really deal with a manuscript as you would want your own manuscript to be dealt with if you were on the other side of the editorial desk. That is very carefully, very thoughtfully, very circumspectly, and very honestly, and also very patiently. And that takes time. And with the kind of pressures on editors these days to produce profits and so on, That kind of time is no longer built into the editorial process in the way it used to be. And as a result, there's less editing. That's one reason. The second reason is simply that there's less training of editors than there used to be, because it's not a profession anymore. That editors now are kind of, if they're trained, it's in marketing and attitudes and smarts and so on, rather than in what's called line editing, which is now looked upon as some kind of, you know, sort of dreary trade that a few old-fashioned editors still practice.
You have said over the years that you're really not interested in developing a specific school of writing or in going with one trend in writing, but to look for good fiction in every area where it exists. Can I ask you, in spite of that, if you think that there's any way of summing up literature in the 80s, if you see any new directions fiction is headed in, or is that a pointless question to ask?
Well, to begin with, I do believe with Henry James that the house of fiction has many windows, and that as a result you honor and respect different kinds of perspectives that fiction brings, that you can love Hemingway and Faulkner and Fitzgerald and not have to, you know, say, well, you know, how can you love Hemingway if you love Faulkner? They're such different writers. As for, you know, new trends and tendencies, I'm kind of troubled that by, you know, certain tendencies abroad today, which I'm troubled by minimalism, which, you know, is sort of a leading vogue right now.
Name some of the writers who you would describe as minimalist.
Well, I mean, the really great exemplars of it are people like Ray Carver or, say, Bobby Ann Mason, whom I don't want to fault, but it's a technique which requires, you know, an extreme ability at condensation and at the handling of tone, and because it's really, you know, the less is more kind of philosophy of expression. But as Bill Gass recently said in the Times, with so much minimalism running today, less is indeed less. And it also is a kind of easy way to write. It's almost like, you know, a kind of a painting you can draw by following the numbers. So that minimal fiction has very easy formulas to follow. The present tense, which makes everything, you know, very accessible and simple and immediate and so on. The fact that characters are not reflective at all. It's almost like Hemingway wrung dry in a certain way. And I think that this is a problem not only for fiction, but in terms of our whole relation of fiction to society, that it appeals to the short attention span. It appeals to the lack of reflectiveness, to a kind of what I can only call literary consumerism. You know, here it's like sun-dried tomatoes. You know, here they are. They're not. It's small. It's compact. You know, you can digest them quickly, and you don't really have to prepare them, what have you. You just consume them, and so much minimal fiction is that way.
You know, we're just about out of time, but there's a couple of things I want to ask you really quickly. One is that I was surprised to hear you mention Bobby Mason in the category you were just criticizing, because you edited her first collection of stories.
That's right. Don't misunderstand me, that masters are masters, and she's a master of minimal fiction. It's just that that, you know, as say with Henry Miller, it had a whole lot of heavy breathing male writers suddenly, you know, writing about one orgasm after another. it just proved to be, you know, a kind of dead end. And so it's not the masters that I'm concerned about. It's the vogue of imitation.
Well, one last question. When you're writing fiction or essays and you get edited by somebody else, is that a difficult experience for you? Do you ever second-guess them, thinking, well, if I were editing this, I would do it differently?
I've had my good experiences and bad experiences. The good ones are people who sort of follow the same kind of advice I try to follow when I'm on the other side of the desk, and that is handle my manuscript as you would like yours to be handled if you were the writer. And that means that you're careful, it means that you're patient, it means that you're honest, it means that you're... and it means you know what you're doing. It means you know what you're doing, that you're an experienced editor. An experienced editor is like an experienced obstetrician. He's very good at deliveries.
Literary editor Ted Solotaroff speaking with Terry Gross in 1987. He died last Friday at the age of 79. Since bursting onto the scene with his 1988 film Tales from the Gimli Hospital, Canadian filmmaker Guy Maddin has been a cult favorite for his daring and originality. But in recent years, especially with the release of The Saddest Music in the World, which starred Isabella Rossellini, his work has developed a more mainstream audience. His latest film, the quasi-autobiographical My Winnipeg, is currently in theaters and available from IFC Video on Demand. And Criterion has just released the DVD of his previous feature, Brand Upon the Brain, a fairy tale family drama that Maddin describes as being 97% true. Our critic-at-large John Powers has been watching both and says that Maddin is one of the world's most wonderfully unorthodox filmmakers.
The funny thing about originality is that the world keeps asking for it, then doesn't know what to do with people who were actually original. A fine example is Guy Maddin, the Canadian filmmaker who makes movies unlike anybody else's. They're a giddy hybrid of silent film, romantic music, and Nabokovian playfulness. Maddin's sensibility is so distinctive that even when he tries to make a commercial picture, like The Saddest Music in the World, it remains far more out there than anything else in our theaters. Still, his audience has begun to expand with the release of two wonderful, critically acclaimed movies that belong to what Maddin has dubbed his Me Trilogy. The new one, his faux documentary My Winnipeg, mingles memories of his hometown with splurges of pure fancy. The other, 2006's Brand Upon the Brain, has just been released on one of the year's coolest DVDs. A great film about childhood, it comes packaged with two delightful short films and the most amusing and revelatory director interview I've ever seen on a disc. Brand on the Brain is hard to describe, but it's not hard to watch. An imaginary riff on Maddin's actual childhood feelings. It begins with a fictional character named Guy Maddin returning to the island where he grew up. He's promptly flooded by memories of his boyhood in a lighthouse that's used as an orphanage by his parents, a father who performs sinister experiments on the kids, and a witchy mother who is, let's say, overbearing. Perched atop the lighthouse with her spyglass that sees everything, this graying woman smothers young Guy and seeks to crush his sister's burgeoning sexuality. The island's oppressive order is shattered by the unexpected arrival of two teen detectives known as the Lightbulb Kids. Before you know it, the orphanage is overrun with Oedipal madness, adolescent randiness, and sudden death. As if that weren't enough, the movie's style is itself delirious. There's no dialogue. Instead, the action is narrated by what Maddin calls an explainer, who tells us what's going on in a tone charged with melodrama. You can get a flavor of this from the opening scene, when Guy first arrives back on the island to the words of the explainer, voiced here by Isabella Rossellini.
Guy Maddin, house painter, swirling around in his little dreams, his little memories. About to return to his childhood home after an absence of 30 years. Summoned by a letter from his mother, also not seen in 30 years. It is my dying wish that you go back to our old home at Black Notch and give the lighthouse two good coats of paint so that I might see it spruce and proper at least once before I pass on. I will come when I'm able, if I am able. Signed, Mother.
When Brand on the Brain first came out, it was a live performance, complete with an in-theater explainer, an orchestra playing Jason Stashek's gorgeous score, a team of Foley artists doing sound effects, and even a so-called castrato singing in a boyish soprano. Naturally, a DVD can't capture this live experience, but Maddin did specially make two short films to celebrate both the castrato, who's charmingly known as the Manitoba Meadowlark, and the whole sound effects team. Plus, the disc gives you a soundtrack with the choice of 8 different explainers, ranging from Rossellini to Laurie Anderson, Eli Wallach to poet John Ashbery. Like David Lynch, to whom he's sometimes compared, Madden is a genuine surrealist. But early in his career, all his swirling inventiveness could be too much. His movies sometimes felt trapped in his head. That's not true of Brand Upon the Brain or My Winnipeg, which are easy to follow and deal with primal emotions we can all understand, especially deep, ambiguous feelings about family. Both movies are dominated by Madden's love-hate relationship to his mother, who still exerts such power over his psyche that she appears less as a woman than a mythological creature. That said, Madden's work isn't actually about childhood anger or resentment. He's not some drearily therapeutic memoirist. Instead, his movies are shot through with profound feelings of loss and regret. We may start Brand Upon the Brain laughing at its sly little jokes and dazzling visual conceits. But to our surprise, we end up being moved. And that's as it should be. For Madden is haunted by passing time, by memory's unreliable attempts to recreate the vanished yet inescapable past, and by our impossible desire to relive the past so that this time, anyway, we can feel and do everything right.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue.